720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday afternoon with me. Lots to do on the program today. A little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking about how Facebook responds to big crises, big emergencies, and hate speech and all of that. I know that's been a topic on all of our minds for the last day in the news cycle. And so we're going to be taking a look at that in based on a piece that was in Bloomberg that really kind of takes a look at that very, very deeply as far as company strategy goes. We're going to be taking a look at that. We're going to talk about the Boeing story that's been unfolding this week. A lot of drama and angst there as well as a big tobacco scheme to market sugary drinks to children. There's been some research that has uncovered this, and we're going to take a look at it. But right now, we're joined by Micah Maidenberg, reporter at Wall Street Journal, who wrote about the restaurant booking app OpenTable. They're in a fight over diners' data. As we all know, customer data, consumer data, it's a really big topic right now, and it's a really valuable thing to a lot of brands, a lot of companies. And so here is yet another instance of this big fight over data. Micah, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Amy, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
Great to talk with you. So talk us through this story. You know, it seems like this is a battle that comes up on a lot of different stages, and right now it's over dining and who gets information about you. But it goes a lot deeper than I think we realize.
Yeah, let me just start by like backing up a little bit, like in talking about the data and its importance. You know, restaurants want to have information about who's coming in and sitting down so they can tailor menus, keep track of, like, you know, if you have an allergy, if you prefer this dish or that kind of wine, that sort of thing. So OpenTable is a huge sort of gatekeeper, you know, for the industry. Lots of people make reservations through OpenTable, you know, through their app or website. And some restaurateurs have been using that data they get from OpenTable in sort of a separate, like, customer relationship management program called Seven Rooms. And OpenTable basically said, well, wait a minute, you can't do that without our permission. And the restaurant folks that were using this other program said, no, this is our data to use because these diners want to come to us and patronize our places. That's the sort of the gist of the dispute or issue that I wrote about. Yeah.
And so timeline-wise, as we're kind of talking through, what has kind of made this bubble up and start to kind of reach this peak point where it's kind of, okay, it's a standoff, right? Someone's got to do something at this point.
Yeah, I mean, like, OpenTable says, like, they noticed, like, activity, like, in their system, and they just didn't know, like, what was going on. Basically, this other program was sort of scraping data, like, out of the, like, via a restaurant company's OpenTable account, and OpenTable said, whoa, you know, we can't have a separate program, a third party that we don't know about, like, taking our data, like, out of our system without our permission. And that's what sort of, like, catalyzed this and kind of made it bubble up.
Right. And I mean,
OpenTable's position is that, like, we're protecting consumer privacy. Like, if you book a table through us, you are agreeing to our terms of service, and we have to protect your contact information and other, you know, relevant details that you may provide when making that reservation.
Right. And I think it's probably a little murky for consumers. You go, because often OpenTable is a service sitting on a restaurant's website, right? You know, you go to their restaurant website and you look and see what's going on, and then you, you go to book your table. So it sometimes it feels like it's unclear where your data is going. And so, what is it that OpenTable has proposed? It seems like they've kind of revamped their pricing strategy, and that's also got restaurants. It sounds like you're in a commercial kitchen now. As a matter of fact, it sounds like you're in a restaurant. But it seems like they're proposing kind of new pricing structures to make up for this, and I'm sure that's a great deal of pushback with restaurants too.
Yeah, so OpenTable basically is now saying to the restaurant operators, like, if you're going to use a third party to scrape our data, you know, about reservations, then you've got to, you know, pay us, basically. You know, before, restaurants were just sort of allowing, you know, third party software providers into, you know, their OpenTable accounts, letting them pull that data out. OpenTable is basically saying, like, okay, you can do that, but you have to go through us and you have to pay us a fee. you know, some restaurateurs that I talked to thought that those costs were prohibitive and unreasonable. You know, OpenTable has a different view, of course.
And so Seven Rooms, where is their position in all this? It seems like they're kind of in the middle of this and probably want everybody to play nicely and probably don't want to hurt their own business. So where are they falling on all of this?
Right. So if I'm, let's say I'm a restaurant operator and I use OpenTable to get diners into my table, into my restaurant, and I have Seven Rooms sort of in the background, you know, as like a software platform to manage to manage the restaurant and create profiles about guests, right? And Seven Rooms would go in and, again, like pull that data out of the OpenTable system. Seven Rooms says, we just want to help the restaurateurs operate their business however they want, and we need to have that access to, you know, the OpenTable data. But the tension is also that OpenTable and Seven Rooms have like competing, you know, are competitors. I mean, Seven Room also has like a reservation sort of offering. They have, and OpenTable is also trying to get into this business of like helping restaurateurs create profiles about, you know, diners. So it's kind of like Seven Rooms wants to work with OpenTable, and OpenTable says they're happy to sort of find a way to work with any third-party provider that a restaurant group may hire. But there's just also some tension there because, like, restaurant groups are using, like, the restaurant groups that use both platforms they're competitors, and that's, you know, part of the rub.
Right, and because they essentially solve two different problems in a way or kind of work in two different ways. You kind of can't use one with one or the other. You kind of need them both if you have a restaurant. So it's kind of
you could just use OpenTable, because OpenTable has like if you're a restaurant, you could use OpenTable to get diners, and you could also use like OpenTable has a product that competes directly, you know, like I said, with Seven Rooms, mm-hmm. creating like table management programming and guest profiles. So, you know, some restaurateurs sort of saw this. Some of the moves by OpenTable as a way, like as OpenTable trying to freeze out a competitor, you know, that OpenTable denies that, but, you know, again, it just goes back to that tension when you have a restaurant group using both platforms that are sort of trying to talk to each other, but they're also competing for business, you know, amongst these like restaurant companies.
Indeed. And then you have, you know, I grew up in a restaurant family myself. And so I know that, you know, having, you know, running a restaurant it's just like just whatever fixes the headache quicker. We just got to go. You know, it's always kind of about speed and efficiency there. So I'm sure that's an interesting headache for restaurant owners. Well, we will keep turning to you for the latest as this story continues to unfold. I'm interested to see how it all shakes out. So thanks so much for being with us today. Micah Maidenberg, reporter at Wall Street Journal. Thanks.
Thanks, Amy.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break. Back in just a bit, and we're going to be talking about research that's uncovered a big tobacco plot to market sugary drinks to children and why. More of that when we come back here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday afternoon. We're up here in the Skyline Studio, the Allstate Skyline Studio, looking down on the green Chicago River and all the revelry, let's say, going on down below. The green-clad revelry, that's for sure. So there's some traffic we're going to keep you updated on as the parade has stepped off and lots of people are out celebrating St. Patrick's Day weekend. So we'll keep you updated on that. But right now, we're joined by Andrew Jacobs, health and science reporter at New York Times, who wrote about research that uncovered a big tobacco plan to market sugary drinks to children. We think about tobacco and sugar not necessarily being in the same family, but nonetheless, two things that aren't that good for us. But why? And there's lots of questions that emerge, right? Why is my first one. Andrew, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Great to be here.
So talk us through this story about this uncovered data and all of this that's kind of led to this piece that you wrote. It is really a fascinating story, and one it's rather shocking to read, but also at the end of it, you're like, well, it's shocking, but it also isn't shocking, right? So talk us through, if you would.
Well, it's not exactly news that tobacco companies owned and sold sugary drinks starting in the 60s up until the late 90s. But researchers that were going through this vast archive at the University of California, they had inherited this huge trove of tobacco industry documents as part of the settlement with states over health-related smoking costs. And they went through these documents, and they found, they were able to trace the evolution of how these companies, Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds, purchased drink brands like Tang, Hawaiian Punch, Capri Sun, and Kool-Aid, and basically turned them from drinks that were just marketed to moms, busy moms who want to, you know, give their kids something to drink, into sort of these children's drinks that were marketed directly to children, and they really sort of got kids hooked on these drinks, which we now know are not good for you because they're mostly sugar. They have some added vitamin C, but mostly they, you know, a lot of experts say these kinds of drinks get kids hooked on the taste for sugary drinks and play a factor in the obesity crisis that's going on right now.
And so given that all this, you know, these documents have come to light and all of this, are there advocacy groups that are starting to do work here, or is there anything that can be done since it's all in the past?
No, I think what part of what the researchers are trying to do is draw attention to the fact that these companies have from the beginning sought to market to children, because right now the industry has is abiding by, or they're trying to abide by this voluntary agreement to not advertise and market these products to kids, but a lot of advocates say they're not doing that, that they skirt around the rules that they've sort of set up. I mean that they're not advertising on classic children's television shows like Nickelodeon, but they advertise the sporting events, things where kids are likely to be watching. So they're hoping to sort of draw attention to these tactics, which are, you know, now 40 years old, 50 years old, and show that this has been going on for a long time, and industries always deny that they market to kids.
Yeah, and so in reporting this story, which for those of you who listening who follow me on social media, I'm going to be sure and tweet this out after the program because I really want you to read this piece for yourself. It's really, really fascinating. But for you, Andrew, in reporting this story, what details were most surprising to you that you came across through that reporting process?
Well, for me, Hawaiian Punch was really resonant because as a kid, I grew up drinking Hawaiian Punch, and I loved it. So when R.J. Reynolds bought Hawaiian Punch in 1963, it was an adult cocktail mixer. It was came in two flavors, and it was sold to adults. As soon as they bought it, they turned around and they took this mascot, Punchy. I don't know if you remember this character who always punches this guy in the face when he says, "How'd you like a nice Hawaiian Punch?" They took this character and they marketed it very heavily on TV and all these kind of branded products and Sunday comics, you know, glasses they sold, and it became this sort of juggernaut. And anyone of a certain age will remember Punchy and Hawaiian Punch. And so what was fascinating to me is how they took a brand that was, you know, not, you know, doing fine, but as a cocktail mixer, and turned it into this children's drink. And they added, you know, 16 flavors, you know, from 2 to 16. And then, of course, back in the 80s, they added many, many more flavors and products, you know, not just in the can, but the juice boxes, the little cans, all kinds of products that were designed to, you know, make it easier for kids to take it and put it in their lunchbox.
Right, right. And in the story also you mentioned Tang, which also those of us of a certain age remember drinking a lot of, and how that kind of that focus shifted to be marketed to different segments of the population at different times, which I also found really interesting.
Yeah, what's interesting is Tang was marketed to moms. It was the idea was, you know, you're a busy mom, you want to get your kids some vitamin C, you put a few spoonfuls in a glass, mix it with water, boom. And the space program was sort of this, the idea that Tang had made it onto the first space launch somehow. Who knows if that was really true. But when Philip Morris bought the brand in the 80s, the brand was pretty much dying. And then they turned around and marketed it to tweens, and they made it this sort of cool, hip drink that advertised with orangutans, and there's all kinds of product tie-ins, and there was a loyalty program where you could get stuff, you know, that was branded with Tang, and now it's a, you know, today it's still a huge profit maker for the company that owns it, but most of the profits come from overseas. So what's happened to a lot of these brands is as Americans become more aware of the dangers of drinking too much sugar or consuming too much junk food, they've really expanded their focus overseas into the developing world. So a lot of the profits come from poor countries where people maybe are not quite as aware of the downfall, the downside of too much sugar.
Yeah, really, really fascinating. Again, for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and share this story because I want you to read it for yourself. Really, really fascinating story from the New York Times. Thank you so much, Andrew Jacobs, for being with us, health and science reporter at New York Times. We will talk to you another time. Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. We're up here in the Allstate Skyline Studio overlooking the green Chicago River and lots of green revelry going on the streets below. But we're going to keep you updated on traffic and street closures and just streets that aren't closed, but lots of people are on them. So we're going to keep you updated on that. Jen DeSalvo's got you covered from the newsroom. We'll check in with her again at the 1 o'clock hour or any time of breaking news. But right now on the program, we're joined by Aaron Gregg, a reporter at Washington Post, who has been covering this week at Boeing because we, as many of us have been following, there was the second of two crashes of their 737 MAX 8 jet and a lot of moving parts. This story moved really quickly this week and it kept getting bigger and a lot of different pieces were moving all at once. So here to talk us through all of that, Aaron Gregg, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Certainly. So for those who maybe weren't following the story so closely or just were overwhelmed by it because there were so many moving parts, give us a little bit of a timeline of what happened after Sunday's Ethiopian Flight 302 crash and how we've gotten to this point now where we have angry pilots, we have this aircraft grounded around the globe. We have really major implications here for this company and people's safety and workers and all of these stakeholders in this.
That's a really great question. It's been sort of a disastrous week for Boeing, as you noted. It all started on Sunday when a 737 MAX 8 went down in Ethiopia, killed 157 people. The next 3 days were followed by intense speculation about whether the same issue was at play in this MAX 8 that went down as the one in Indonesia a couple months back. That speculation was actually confirmed to an extent. In the middle of the week through an FAA document which noted, based on satellite analysis and something, we don't know what, that they found in the wreckage, which indicated that according to the FAA, there is some commonality between those two crashes. That was a little bit of a bombshell for the company because it indicates that there might be something wrong with the plane and not with the pilots.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, immediately, I think one detail that emerged, you know, just watching Boeing perform financially and watching, you know, stock market things, how that played out quickly, people were kind of stepping away from Boeing. We saw their second biggest stock tumble in one day since the trading
That's
opened
right.
after 9/11. That was very significant for them. And a detail emerged that I thought was very interesting of the stakes, I think, puts the stakes in perspective about how this particular aircraft really accounts for a significant portion of their operating revenue, as much as could be up to a third. So I think the stakes for them to figure this out are quite high.
That's right. So the 737 is effectively the best performing aircraft financially for Boeing in not only Boeing's history, but in the history of aviation. So the idea that the latest, most advanced, most reliable, as Boeing put it in their advertising documents, version of this plane is really damaging for the next couple of years for this company. Analysts are telling me that the immediate financial impact won't be so bad in the grand scheme of things. I think the most ambitious estimate was $5 billion for a $100 billion a year company. But the broader worry is what's the reputational damage here? I mean, are people going to remember these two incidents every time they step onto a 737 MAX for the near future? I mean, I'm sure that the company will find the right fix for this, even if it takes them a little while and even if it proves very expensive, but I think there's a real crisis of confidence right now.
Yeah, I think it also did not help yesterday when news emerged that just timing of how companies go, it's unfortunate timing, but the CEO received his 2018 bonus. So that part emerged where he's getting this, you know, multi-million dollar bonus in the middle of this crisis. So I think there seems like there's a lot going on with the narrative of Boeing. Then you have pilots who were at this meeting with Boeing executives. You know, pilots were very angry because they felt like they were very much in the dark about a lot of details around the software here.
That's true. You brought up a good point. One of the things that the pilots are angry about is they're worried that Boeing has basically compromised safety in the name of financial performance. The worry is that in the hurry to push out this MAX 8 and basically, you know, have it go gangbusters in the global market, they might have not put as much emphasis on training as they could have. It's not clear whether the decisions to do that were made for financial reasons, but I think that if any evidence of that effect emerges, it could entail a lot of legal liability for Boeing. They already face lawsuits from, I think, 50 or so deceased members of victims of the Indonesia flight, and that was before this latest crisis. Yeah. Now we're hearing about possible congressional hearings, all sorts of issues at play here.
Yeah, well, that was my very next question, is what are we looking at on the horizon, and what are kind of the next couple of milestones we could be looking at in this story?
So I think the thing to do right now is to first and foremost just keep your eye on this black box, on what is the evidence. We still haven't totally resolved that. What we've seen so far is definitely it's very damaging on its face, but we still don't have the full story, and we probably won't for a while. Beyond that, I think somebody needs to take a broader look at the certification process that allowed this plane to proceed the way it did. Mm-hmm. The FAA, for a long time, has been moving towards something they call self-certification, which basically means that there are designated Boeing employees who are designated by the FAA to sign off on equipment changes. So think about that. There are employees who are paid by Boeing who are doing the role of the FAA. I don't know that that's what played a role here, but I think the government oversight of this aircraft approval process needs to be unpacked a little bit.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly, in as much as you've been covering this story this week, what details of it have been most surprising to you just in reporting the story?
I think it's the level of consternation you see from pilot groups is very palpable here. The idea that safety would be compromised in the name of profit, we don't know that that's what happened here, but even the possibility that that was what took place, and that it not only put pilots' jobs at risk and made it hard for pilots to do their jobs, but literally caused the death of more than 300 people, I think it's just terrifying and enraging if you're a pilot, because you want to be in full control. And regardless of whether the plane is faulty or not, when you sit down in that cockpit and you turn on your microphone and you tell a flight full of people that you're about to take off and go one city over or one country over, you know, you're all of those people are putting their trust in you. And the idea that the equipment might have made it hard for you to keep those people safe is just terrifying beyond belief for pilots.
Yeah, truly, truly. And some pundits have been emerging in social media, and lots of people kind of swirling around in the PR realm anyway, kind of talking, well, this is what I would do, this is how I would tell. You know, at this point, what my read on it is that it seems like Boeing has not, seems like they're just kind of like, let's let everything emerge first. It doesn't seem like Boeing's taken any huge steps to try to control this narrative or try to spin it. It seems like they're kind of laying low, which tells me that there's a plan being formulated, but it's not there yet.
That does appear to be the case. The one major move that they did make was they announced on Monday evening that in response to an FAA directive that was basically developed, you know, in discussion with Boeing, they would be issuing a software fix for this automated feature that everybody is focused on right now. They also, which was seen as a little bit of a reversal from what they initially said they would do, are now pushing for new training on the system. That's a big change. However, it came after that second crash. There were 4 months between Indonesia and Ethiopia where they could have made these changes. I mean, I have no evidence to suggest that doing so would have saved the lives of the people on Ethiopia, on the Ethiopian flight, but you have to ask the question of why did it take a second crash for them to do that?
Yeah, indeed. Well, we'll keep turning to you for the latest as this story continues to unfold. And as you said, we will, you know, be looking for what happens when the full scope of the full report of the black box data is released. Thanks so much for being with us today, Aaron Gregg, reporter at Washington Post.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to take a look about Facebook and how they and other social media platforms and how they're really handling themselves in moments of big crisis, in big emergency, and around hate speech. More of that when we return on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth. Here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday. You know, as the events in New Zealand have continued to unfold, a lot of us are watching that story, and a lot of people are turning to social media and asking about, you know, what is the responsibility there? What is the plan? Do these platforms have a strategy or not? And how are things, you know, when we're able to flag a post, how come some get taken in one way, some get taken another? I think we've all been in a situation where we've flagged something or seen something really inflammatory that and then later a platform has said it didn't really meet the criteria for being taken down. I think that's frustrating a lot of people, especially when we see, you know, a large crisis happen and unfolding around it and posts that and incite hate speech or incite violence, things like that. So that's, I think, a topic on a lot of people's minds right now. So we're joined now by Sarah Fryer, tech reporter at Bloomberg, who wrote about this very thing, about Facebook's strategy or lack thereof for responding to crises on the platform. Sarah, thanks so much for being with us today. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
So talk us through this, if you would. You know, this story is certainly extremely timely this morning as you know, comments from the White House have come out and a lot of people are really talking about, well, speech does matter and the things we say do matter. And if someone is prone to violence, perhaps speech can incite them to do more. And we have to, you know, it's inevitable. A lot of us are looking at tech companies and tech platforms and saying, what responsibility do they have and what is their plan? What did you find in your reporting on this story?
Well, I've spent a few months digging into Facebook's content moderation policies and in the process learned how they deal with mass shootings. And when you put a story like this out, you really don't hope that it can be as timely as it is.
Right.
It was one of those situations where Facebook says in my story that they deal with crises like this, like a mass shooting, once a week. And so they have this procedure that they go through when this happens. They ban the shooter. They try to take down the video. They try to take down anything that praises the shooter. And they try to memorialize the victim's accounts. And they're doing all this as people continue to share and upload the video. In this case, you know, the bad actors on these platforms have gotten a lot savvier about how to manipulate them for things to go viral. And that's really what happened in this case. It was a murderer who's extremely online and his tendencies. But it just speaks to this larger issue with Facebook that they are inherently reactionary about how they deal with these crises. Things come up, they become a big issue, and eventually, once there's enough outrage in the public, then they figure out what to do about that specific issue. But then the next one comes up, and the next one, and the next one. And it's just this never-ending cycle of crises.
Indeed. And yeah, as you noted, it should be said, this story came out prior to the events in New Zealand and very unfortunate timing, but nonetheless, a very timely topic, one we're thinking about quite a bit. In the story that you wrote, and for those of you who follow me on social media, I'm going to share this out after the program because I really want you to read this for yourself. It's really excellent reporting and a lot of excellent information in here. But in particular, you bring up how not all posts are created equal and not all hate speech is created equal. And it largely depends on what community, where in the world that is being discussed as to Facebook's reaction.
Facebook is trying to create rules that it calls scalable, which is what they mean when they say they want something that can apply to everyone in every country that they serve, all 2.7 billion users who use either Facebook or Instagram or Messenger or WhatsApp. Those are all owned by Facebook. And they want these rules to be broadly applicable, but you have different cultures and you have different contexts for things that go wrong. And I think the bigger problem here, and one of the things that somebody in Sri Lanka, where there was a lot of ethnic violence, pointed out to me, it's that people get radicalized on these platforms and the misinformation piles up. And Facebook is addressing the problem, but not the symptom of the problem in many ways. And so, you know, it's just not a very sustainable solution to these really damaging aspects of their platform for society.
Yeah, and as you note in the piece, there's a line, I think, that encapsulates so much of what you of how you describe this reporting system and these community standards that they're working towards. And that is, the standards can seem comically absurd in their specificity. We can't even say on the air some of the things that are specifically outlined in these standards that really, it seems like they're because they're so specific, even they offer these strange loopholes and you're asking people to, you're asking human beings to make calls on things that perhaps they don't necessarily have the context for, that, not to mention there's 2.7 billion users. And then, as you also note, the reporting system relies on low wage human moderators with, and software that's under resourced. Like these are, you know, it seems that what they're standing behind so proudly seems inherently very, very flawed and prone to human error and just, you know, burnout. I think we all saw a story a couple of weeks ago, talking about members of this team on Facebook that was just kind of under resourced and really kind of burned out and morale was quite low. So it seems like it's hard to understand when you have this tech giant saying, we're taking this very, very seriously. You have Zuckerberg saying we're taking a broader view of our responsibility when there's details like that emerge.
Well, one example that's a little milder but gives you a sense is during the Me Too movement, when women would post on Facebook about the men and naming the men that they say harassed or sexually assaulted them, and Facebook would take those posts down in some cases and not in others because they were not really sure what to do. Does this fall under their targeted harassment policy if it's not true? And who are they to say that it's not true, that this guy did this thing to this woman? So months and months of agonizing over whether there should be a rule, and if there is a rule, what should it say? And finally, in December, which I think is maybe at least 6 months since they started discussing this, and long after the Me Too movement began, they decided that it was okay for a woman to mention the name of a man they say assaulted them, but they couldn't advocate for retaliation against this person. So if you're a person in a content moderation hub, you're making near minimum wage to look at all of this horrible content, and you have to make a split-second decision when you see a woman's post. Is she calling for retaliation against this person or not? What does retaliation mean? If she says, you know, don't go on a date with him, is that retaliation? Or is it like, you know, he should die? And they have to decide in that moment, subjectively, you know, what they should do, and just over and over make decisions like that, and within a few minutes or even seconds.
It's really, really fascinating. I wish we had another hour. I still have so many questions I want to ask you about this. But again, for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and share this piece out because it's really fascinating reporting. And I really appreciate you joining us today, Sarah Fryer, tech reporter at Bloomberg.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. All right, we're going to take a little break. We're going to get you to news and all the good stuff, but we're also going to check in with Scott Catoon and see what's coming up on the Startup Showcase coming up at 1:05. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.